This is a matrix product state. Remember, the open legs refer to the sides of the lattice, and so this would be a matrix product state for a state on 16 sides. Okay. Next to it, you have another tensor network called multiscale entanglement renormalization engines, or MIRA for short. And the first thing you see is that this looks very different from a matrix product state. But I want you to pay attention to the fact that if we count open legs, there are 16. And you want to think of this as another ansatz for the same type of system, for a one-dimensional system. Okay? So that would be a tensor network that we use to efficiently represent wave functions of one-dimensional systems on a lattice. And just for comparison, we have the quantum circuit that we discussed. And again, if we were to start with a product state up here, we'd see that, again, we have 16 open legs down there. And so these are three different tensor networks to represent states of the same system, a one-dimensional system, in this case, with 16 sides. OK, so yesterday we saw that the correlators in the NPS scale as exponentially for large distances, where L is the distance between two points. Okay, so a correlator between these two points at the distance L decays exponentially with L. We also saw that the entropy saturated to constant, and that was given, I don't even remember, 2 times log to chi, some constant. Let's just say a constant. And this had to do a lot with the fact that we just had to cut two bond indices, in order to split the wave function into a part that contained the indices corresponding to the region we care and the rest of the system. So what we would like to do now is to consider these other ansatz, the MIRA. And what we will discuss today is analogous properties. But what we will see is that the correlations will decay as a power law. Okay? We'll see that correlations decay as a power law. So again, we'll have, we'll look at some block of some size, okay? And remember that the key point here this was coming from the fact that this correlator could be expressed as there was some transfer matrix, okay, to the Lth power involved in that. There was some transfer matrix to the Lth power, and then we had some other objects here, some vector and another vector. The important thing is that there was a transfer matrix to the Lth power. And that means that we would pick up some eigenvalue of this transfer matrix, and we would bring it to the Lth power, and automatically this implied exponential decay of correlations. What we'll see here is that we will actually have another transfer matrix. So this will come from the fact that this can be re-expressed roughly as some vector. Maybe let's not get confused, so I'm going to call this vector left, vector right. So here we'll have some vector left again, some vector right. And we have a new transfer matrix, okay? But this one will be to the power log L, okay? So we'll see that we can find correlators in this structure. The computation of correlations within the MIRA involves an expression where there is some transfer matrix again, but instead of Lth power, okay, we'll see that it's only log L power. And automatically, this will imply polynomial decay of correlations. So here, this transfer matrix, and I'll discuss this a bit more in detail, okay? But I'm just trying to give you first the big picture, describe the big picture. So here, this transfer matrix had to do with moving in real space, okay? And if you had to move L sides, you had the Lth power. Here, this transfer matrix will have to do with moving in scale. We will see that this direction, this extra direction that we have here, corresponds to scale in the system. And what this means, this expression, what it reflects is the fact that to compute this correlator, we'll have to move in scale log L times, and that will justify the fact that instead of exponential decay of correlations, we have polynomial decay of correlations. We will also see that the entropy, in this case, instead of scaling as a constant, will scale as log L, okay? Logarithm. And this will have to do with the fact that if we try to split this region from the rest of the wave function, we'll have to break a number of bonds. So we'll look for the best upper bound we can get, and this will involve going up in a scale, in this scale direction, and we'll see that the number of bonds we have to break is logarithmic in L. So if we had the smaller region here, we would only have to break a couple of bonds, and as you can see the larger and larger regions, you realize that you have to break more and more bonds in order to split the wave function into two pieces, one containing the region you're interested and one containing the rest of it. Right? So you can see that as I move, as I increase L, okay, I have, when I try to split the wave function into two pieces, I have to break a number of bonds that increases. And it turns out to increase logarithmically in L. Okay? So that's one thing we want to see. Now, these are the properties, the structural properties we will see. Polynomial decay of correlations, as opposed to exponential decay of correlations in the MPS, and logarithmic scaling of the entropy, as opposed to saturation or constant. But what about computational aspects, right? Is this going to be efficient? And remember that, well, it turns out that this can be visualized as a quantum circuit. I may insist on that, but not now. But the idea is we should go back to the previous quantum circuit that we had, and remember that we had a problem with it. It was an efficient representation, but it was hard to efficiently, well, it was not possible to efficiently compute with it if the depth, unless we put some limit on to the depth of the circuit. And what was the problem that we had there? If we started, say, with a region of, just for comparison, I'm considering here a region of three sites, say these three sites, and I look at what gates are in the past causal cone. Okay? I look at past causal cone, and I realize that all these gates that you find here, can influence the state, the produced density matrix down here. So this defines the past causal cone of a region, okay? All the gates that could be involved in deciding what state we have here. And remember that we had that if this was t, then the past causal cone was 2 times t, okay? And that we had a problem because the cost was exponential in the width of the causal cone. So the key aspect here is the width of the causal cone. At any previous time, the width could be measured as how many subsystems we have at a given previous time, right? You go back in time and you realize that this number is increasing, okay? The number of wires that you have. So that was the origin of a computational problem. And let's have a quick look at what happens with the mirror. We can start with a region of, again, three sites. And we go back in time, okay? And this is a bit messy, but don't worry, I'll go back to this later. And what you can see, and I'll discuss this in a sec, is that you start with three wires, 1, 2, 3, and as you go back in time, there are two effects. One is the causal cone is expanding, okay? So as in here, the causal cone is expanding. That's one effect. But the other effect is that we're removing, you see that we have these tensors that I'll describe more in detail in a couple of minutes, these tensors have two legs down here and one up there. You can think of this as if you had a unitary gate on two qubits, but you fix the state of one of the incoming legs, okay? So whenever you see this, just think, okay, I have a two-qubit gate, a two-body gate, one of those, but such that one of the inputs is fixed to some zero state. And then the end result of this is that you start with a width involving three wires, and as you go up, if you look at here, again we have 1, 2, 3 wires. And if we could keep going up, we see 1, 2, 3 wires, okay? So it turns out that the width of the causal cone is constant. It doesn't increase as you go back in time. Okay? And so the cost, which is exponential in this width, is completely under control. It's the exponential of a constant. Okay? Doesn't grow. Okay? So we'll see all these ideas. But the summary is that we'll have polynomial decay of correlations due to the way we'll see that there are geodesics defined in this two-dimensional tensor network. We'll have logarithmic scaling of the entropy due to the richer connectivity within the tensor network. And we will have efficiency of computations due to this causal cone structure. Okay. So and yeah, maybe I want to mention that these properties, if you remember what we discussed the first week, these properties, polynomial decay of correlations and logarithmic scaling of the entropy, match properties of ground states of one-dimensional systems, but critical ground states, or gapless ground states. Okay? So this was MPS match properties of gapped ground states, or ground states of gap Hamiltonians, and the mirror will match properties of ground states of gapless Hamiltonians in one.
The reason that the Mayron consider the past causal cone, compare the Mayron and the quantum circuit, the reason that the Mayron is not well controlled for this cost,
yeah,
is due to that the bump for each Mayron is spanned by the dimension of the Schmidt coefficient.
The what?
Schmidt
coefficient. No, but the what, the band?
The bound.
The bound dimension?
The bound of each.
The boundary?
Each leg.
I'm sorry?
The leg.
Its leg, yeah.
The dimension for each leg is not D or the chi?
No. That could be D. I mean,
that could be D.
Yeah, that's not the point. The point is that it has the way the gates are connected. The quantum circuit, the way the gates are, the layout of gates, the wires are such that you have a quantum, a pass cone structure where all pass cones have constant width. Okay? And that automatically will mean that we can efficiently compute. But we'll see this in a minute.
Yes. So this mirror looks to me like what I would imagine if I had to draw the normalization.
I'm going to start talking about this right now.
Okay.
Yes. So did anybody, I mean, are there copies left of the, yeah, can you distribute them around if somebody doesn't have? So let me start by motivating why that quantum circuit and not something else, regardless of computational efficiency. Okay, let's forget about for a second that what we need is to have some useful tool in the sense that we can use it for computations. And I want you to think about a lattice. Okay, that's a lattice made of with sides. Right, and I think that you did, well, the tutorial yesterday was organized so that you would start thinking about these problems. And so imagine that we want to coarse grain the sides of this lattice. So every side is described by a vector space, which has some finite dimension, say C, D, D dimensional. Okay. And now what we want to do is we want to take this into a coarse grain lattice. We want to be able to simplify this problem or this system by identifying degrees of freedom that the degrees of freedom that are relevant to say the description of the ground state or low energies. And what we want to do is we want to take every two sides, we want to produce just one side. Okay? So that's our goal. Okay, so we would like to end up with, if we started with n sides, we want to end up with n prime equal to n over 2 sides. Okay? And a way we could do this is by taking the tensor product of every 2 sides. So we could take every 2 sides, right? This has some vector space, and now what we could do is we could look at some subspace within this tensor product, some such space, that somehow we have the intuition or we have some method to identify the such space such that it preserves the degrees of freedom that are relevant to the ground state, the low energy degrees of freedom. And so you've seen renormalization, I'm assuming. But what we're trying to do here is real space renormalization. We don't want to go to momentum space and integrate out some momenta and so on. We want to do it in real space. So we take two sides, take the tensor product of the vector spaces. So that's the vector space describing these two sides. And there we try to identify some such space. Okay? And then we define some tensor, which is just a change of basis, which contains the degrees of freedom that we want to keep. Okay? And we could do this everywhere. And so it looks like a tensor network, which is not very well connected so far, but this represents a linear map, right? Every two sides, this is a linear map that tells you what you have to keep. It's a map between states of one side in terms of states of two sides. So, and this would be the idea that you take two sides together, you look at the vector space, you just decide which degrees of freedom, which subspace you want to keep. Now, in the mirror, we do something on top of this. Okay? In the mirror, or imagine that now we increase this transformation by including extra components, okay, which are gates, again, involving two sides, and so on. So what this means is I still have exactly the same goal as before. I want to take these two sides into one side. But before I take these two sides together into one side, I'm going to let the neighboring, so as I said, my goal is to end up replacing two sides with one side, okay? But before I do that, I let this the right side, I allow for a unitary transformation or for this side to interact with the neighboring one and for this side to interact with the neighboring one, okay? So might be like kind of a mystery why we want to do this, but you had an exercise yesterday. Where did anybody get that far yesterday? One person? Several people? Several of you? So what you could see is that without including this untangler, okay, the coarse-grained picture had to have many more degrees of freedom. I don't know, well, do you remember the context? So we had each side was made of two spin 1/2 degrees of freedom. We had several sides. And now the state was an entangled state, a product of singlets in this way. And now what you can see is that if you try to put two sides together, say these two sides together, then the effective side that you obtain, the effective side has to still account for the entanglement. There's entanglement between this effective side and the other effective sides. Okay. It's just this short-range entanglement that we had is preserved during the transformation. So if we don't have the red tensors here, the effective sides will be entangled still. Now, if before putting these guys together, we allow for these two sides to interact with each other, we can use this interaction, this unitary evolution, to remove this entanglement. Okay? We use these entanglers that we call them, to remove this short-range entanglement. And as a result, we started with, after removing this entanglement, the effective picture is there is no entanglement left. So what that means is, we started with a system where there was nearest neighbor entanglement, and we end up with a system where there is no entanglement left. Okay, so For this reason, we call these gates, we call them disentanglers. The goal of having these gates is to remove entanglement from the system, short-range entanglement from the system.
But it seems like if you do that once, then you remove all the entanglement.
In this case, yes, because this state that we were looking at had a very small amount of entanglement. It was only, it had entanglement, but it was only short range, right, between nearest sites, nearest neighbor sites. But in general, you could imagine that you also had entanglement between one site and another site, which are far away. And then that would still be preserved into the next picture, into the next, the effective lattice. Okay, so this is the intuition, the reason why this entrance was proposed. It was a way of improving on the situation where you don't have these entanglers. In that situation, you start with a ground state that has a short-range entanglement, and this short-range entanglement doesn't go away. Okay, we saw that if we don't put these disentanglers, the short-range entanglement between sites would survive the coarse graining. If we had short-range entanglement between two sites down here, it will become short-range entanglement between two effective sites. If you introduce these entanglers, you can get rid of this short-range entanglement. Okay, so then when you can go back here and think of you can now think of a layer of this form as a coarse grain transformation that, as we said, is mapping some lattice that will map some lattice L into some effective lattice L prime. Okay. And then we can think of this indeed as a renormalization group transformation. As a renormalization group transformation. And we can iterate it. The difference between this and Wilson approach that you could use in field theory is that this is in real space. We never go to momentum space. We can, and the advantage of this is that you don't need your theory to look nice in momentum space. It doesn't have to be free theory or a theory that can be expressed as a perturbation, small perturbation of a free theory. This is a transformation that you can do in real space for any initial Hamiltonian. Yes?
But I don't understand why we want to disentangle it arbitrary.
Why do we want that? Okay, so the motivation for that is that if you don't get rid of short range, so think about the spirit of the contraction of the RG flow. What we want is we want to get rid of short range microscopic degrees of freedom or short range details so that we end up with an effective description at long distances that does not depend on microscopic details. It only keeps the essence of the state. What I mean by this is we would like to find a renormalization group flow that two theories that only differ in microscopic details would flow into the same fixed point. Okay? So we want to get rid of short distance details that are not essential to the phase. If we don't do that, you could start with, so imagine if you use disentanglers, then you have say that this is the space of theories, and you have a flow, an RG flow. Several theories with different microscopic details may still flow to the same fixed point. Now imagine, for a second, that we didn't get rid of short-range entanglement. So these three theories differ in this short-range entanglement. If we don't get rid of it, they will not flow to the same point, right? They will keep with them the short-distance details. Okay, so if you want to have a coarse grain transformation, this is a coarse grain transformation from L to L prime that is compatible with the spirit of the renormalization group flow, you have to make sure you remove high energy degrees of freedom or high energy properties or short distance properties, okay, that are not essential to the phase. And if you don't use these entanglers, this will not happen. So you need these entanglers for this to happen. Yes.
So I remember in the at the beginning of the second lecture, you mentioned that the local unitary transformation will preserve the Smith number.
Okay. So by these are acting on two sides, right? So they are not. We use local in two different senses. One means involving a small number of sites, and the other one means involving just one site. So this unitary transformation is acting on two sides.
So it's not.
It can change the Smith number that would correspond to this partition, where one site is on one side. So you have two sites here. One would correspond to A, and one would correspond to B. If you don't have this disentangler, if you apply a circuit like this or a transformation like this, you will not change the if you apply this to some entangled state between parts A and B, you will not change the entanglement spectrum. But if you include this transformation here, this unitary transformation here, this is connecting A and B. It's not local with respect to the partition AB. It's non-local. It affects both A and B at the same time. So this transformation has the ability of changing the entanglement spectrum of this bipartition of the system.
So you need to choose a specific disentangler so that you can reduce the entanglement rather than increase.
Yes, yes. So there are many aspects about how we are going to choose this, which I will not discuss in detail. But I just want you to agree that this opens the possibility. So it leaves the possibility of, if you choose it properly, to remove entanglement. If you put a random choice, given some initial ground state here, a random choice of this entangler will probably increase the amount of entanglement, a random choice. But if you choose them carefully, the important thing is you have the ability to modify the amount of entanglement. And we'll choose this gate so that it removes entanglement from the ground state. And the example that you studied yesterday in the tutorial is the one you want to keep in mind. All right, so once we have a coarse-grained transformation like this, it's interesting to look at what happens to a local operator. And by a local operator now, I mean an operator that is acting on three sites. Okay? But before I discuss this, I need to remind to tell you one more thing. So I've already introduced the disentanglers. I'm going to call these other guys isometries. Okay, the 2-to-1 guys, the ones that identify which such space you want to keep from a tensor product of two sides, we call them isometries. The tensors that try to remove entanglement from the ground state, we call them disentanglers. And it turns out that they fulfill some conditions. So if the disentangler, we call it W, then if you multiply it with W dagger, they give rise to the identity. This is just a way of a tensor network way of writing that if we apply first W and then W dagger, this is equal to the identity. And that's similar to what you have with the unitary transformation. Okay, if you had the unitary transformation, U dagger, and so on, well, it's the identity. But here, we just have this condition. And then similarly, for the disentanglers, we'll have that, I'm going to call this U dagger. This is the identity on two sides. All right, this is saying that if you first apply U and then U dagger, you get the identity on two sides. So let me stress this. With a matrix product state, we had tensors. With the meta, we have tensors, but not arbitrary tensors. These tensors fulfill some constraint. Okay, one is this constraint. So W dagger is the identity. We choose the tensors to fulfill this constraint. You still have many possibilities, many variational parameters, but we enforce this condition, and the disentanglers fulfill this condition. Okay? And that's key to having efficiency later on. So it is important that we restrict our attention to tensors W and U that fulfill this condition. And with this condition, then we can study what happens to the coarse graining of a local operator. Oops. Yep.
It looks yesterday in the tutorial like W dagger equals the identity but on a different state. Is that true in general?
I'm sorry? On a state?
It looked yesterday in the tutorial like W dagger equals the identity just on a different space. Is that true in general?
So W, we define W such that it's acting from the effective site into tensor product of two sites. So it's acting, so if you compose it W dagger, it's a map from an effective site into an effective site. And so this is a linear map, it has to be the identity when acting on. So WW dagger is the identity when acting on the vector space of an effective site. Is that an answer to your question?
Okay. Just that it is analogous to the W dagger W. If you take your identity but reverse the W.
So you mean if I first write W and W dagger instead?
Yes.
No, then I don't have anything to say about that. This condition does not imply the other one. And we only need this condition. OK, so what I'm saying in the end is we have a bunch of tensors connected in a particular way. And these tensors are restricted to fulfill some constraints. Okay? You can take it this way. And then let's have a look at what happens when we cross-grain a local operator. So if this is a transformation for states, remember, if we have a state and we transform it with some transformation, n, then an operator, we transform it by conjugation, right? That's how, if we transform a state in the vector space by a linear map, the way we transform operators in the vector space is by conjugation, by that linear map. So if this is how we transform states, then if we had an operator that I choose to act on three sites for a reason that will become clear soon, then this is the map we're applying. Now the conjugate looks like this. So that would be applying the map to the operator and its conjugate. Okay. So this is how we transform operators. This is how we obtain, given a local operator on the original lattice, that would be, you see, it has three incoming legs, three outgoing legs. So this is a local operator acting on three sites of the original lattice. And this big thing here is the coarse grain operator, how this operator looks when you look at it from the in the coarse grain lattice. Yes?
So what happens when I take two sites into one is that you're taking the combined Hilbert spaces into.
Yes, you take the combined Hilbert, the tensor product of the two sites.
Yeah.
And you identify some subspace that you want to keep in there.
Okay, so then how do you do the converse operation though? Because, I mean, I can understand.
The converse operation is you start with the subspace.
Yes.
And you see how this looks in the original vector space. So it's just some such space in the original vector space.
Okay. I mean, I guess to me it seems as if you are losing information when you
cross
grain. But then,
yes,
but then you have the converse operation. Like does it mean that this like W dagger thing that means it's invertible? And how can you invert something?
No, it's not invertible. It is not invertible.
Okay. So this W dagger thing doesn't mean this.
This W dagger, so if I give you a matrix that is not square,
yeah,
you can still take the transpose and the complex conjugate, mm-hmm, right? The transpose looks
But this is not a linear
like
operation,
this?
Right?
Sorry?
But this is not a linear operation.
It is linear.
But you're dropping information.
That's fine. You can, so if you have a projector,
yeah.
The projector is linear. It loses, you know, it projects out some information, but it's linear. So what I'm saying is you have a linear map. Every time you write a matrix, even if it's not square, that's already, you can interpret this as a linear map. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying that once you have a linear map, you can transpose it and complex conjugate. Okay. Right? And now what we enforce is that the product of these two is equal to some other map, which is the identity. Okay? So that's what this condition is. So if that's, you know, it's hard to build intuition about what all this means, but just think about this as some constraint in our tensors. Our tensors are constrained. So when we choose the coefficients that fill the tensor, we have these coefficients are not completely random. They have to fulfill some global conditions as expressed by these relations. And now we want to use the relations to see what happens to our local operator when we cosgrain it. Okay, we'll obtain an operator acting on the cosgrain side. And this is not looking very nice because we started with an operator. If you want, you can think of this operator as being non-trivial, doing something non-trivial on three sides of the original lattice, and acting as the identity on the rest of the system. So we call it local because it's only non-trivial in a small region. Okay? It takes three sides, that's something non-trivial on these three sides, but it's doing nothing on the rest of the system. Okay? That's a local operator. If I apply sigma z on one side, I'm doing nothing on the rest of the sides. It's the same as applying the identity on the rest of the sides. So this operator here is doing only something non-trivial on these three sides. And now we apply the cosgrain transformation. And what we see is that we went from a local operator, which was non-trivial only on three sides, to a mess. These are the sides of the cosgrain system. And you can see that it's non-trivial everywhere. Okay, we went from local to non-local. Yes?
How many sides do you consider local? Three is arbitrary number.
Any constant, something that will not depend on the system size. So we can, yeah. But for some reason in this particular scheme, three is the key, is the magic number. And you'll see right now why. So I'm saying this looks like a non-local operator, but let's have a look closer, okay, to it. So I just said that we had these constraints. U and U dagger, identity. So we come here and we say, oh wow, this is U and this is U dagger. Okay, so I can locally come here and replace this with identity. I'm just using the rule. So I can remove this. And replace it with identity. These are constraints that my tensors fulfill, so this is a legal step. So. And this goes on forever. But now I realize, oh, the same thing applies here. This is U and U dagger, so I can remove this and replace it with identity. Okay? And the same applies to here. Okay? And it doesn't matter how many other, I mean, I didn't draw what's going on here, but you imagine that you can do the same everywhere, except, of course, in this place here, because this is U dagger, but they are not multiplied together. There is something in between. We played that game with the quantum circuit a couple of days ago. Right? That whenever we don't have any abstraction, whenever we see that we have U and U dagger, we can remove them. And now we say, oh, look at this. This is W, and this is W dagger. Okay? So we come here and say, oh, the rule applies. So I can replace this whole thing with an identity. And W dagger, identity. I come here, say, oh, I cannot do that because this is W dagger, but there is something in between. So I have to leave it. But I come here, I said, W dagger, good. I can replace these two with identity. Okay? And the same applies to the rest of the system, and so on. So, we started with an operator that was acting on three sides, non-trivially on three sides of the original lattice. And if you look at the result now, this operator, this whole thing represents an operator which is acting as the identity on most of the sides of the cosine lattice, except for three sides. Okay? So this has become, we could just now put a big box here and paint it and forget about the details inside. This is a local operator acting on three sides of the coarse grain lattice. Okay? So that is the key. That is the key. That when we consider coarse graining transformation of this form, if we apply it to local operators, we obtain back local operators. If we in this quantum circuit here, this would not have been the case. Your local operator keeps expanding, okay, and becomes non-local. With a coarse-graining transformation that we are considering here, local operators are mapped into local operators. Any question? It's a good time to ask questions because that's when I stop drawing things and we use okay, so we have this coarse-graining transformation that preserves locality of operators. There are a couple of questions. Yes.
So what is renormalized in here? So we coarse-grained and we got the new operator that's sort of self-similar.
No, it's still local. We don't know if it's
self-similar. Well, on three sites, right? You trace and you go, well, you trace, you take out.
We didn't trace anything in this
the
time.
Box. We compute the box and
yeah.
We get the new operator.
Yes, but it's not self-similar. At this point, it's just a new operator.
Okay.
What it has in common with the original one is that it's on three sides.
Okay.
Non-trivial on three sides. Okay. So don't worry about renormalization yet. We have a coarse-grained transformation. We have a map from our original lattice to a coarse-grained lattice. That's all we have so far. Yes, Nicole? Good. So now a trick. I've been talking about isometries that map two sides into one. Okay, there is nothing fundamental about this. We could work with isometries that map three sides into one. And for some derivations, it's much easier to use. But to use three sides into one, it just makes things easier to explain. There is nothing fundamental about the change. Okay, so I will go on now with blocking three sides into one. But we're doing exactly the same. We have a coarse-grained transformation from n sides to n over three sides now, because every three sides go into one. And we have these entanglers that are applied to the boundaries of the block. So our goal is to take these three sides together into one. And before we do that, by means of an isometry, we apply these entanglers, okay, that affect neighboring blocks. Okay, and these are the constraints that we just discussed, where WWDAGA is the identity, and UUDAGA, so isometries and these entanglers fulfill these constraints. And this is what happens. I just explained this, but with the new isometry. So what happens in this scheme is that locality, or the natural unit of locality here, is two sides. So this operator here acting on two sides, when we coarse-grain it to obtain an operator in the coarse-grain lattice, we see that, well, we apply all the constraints, and we obtain that indeed this goes back to a two-side operator. Okay, that's exactly what I just explained before, but in the particular case where isometries are going from three sides to one. Good. So what's the mirror then? The mirror is this. The mirror is just a tensor network that you obtain by considering this coarse-grain transformation from original lattice to a coarse-grain lattice, and then iterating. Right? You apply a similar coarse-grain transformation again and again until your system that started with n sides has become a very small system, and then you could put some top tensor there to stop. Yes?
Well, I don't see why it doesn't. So you're saying it doesn't become bigger?
The castle cone?
The box you drew?
it's not becoming bigger, right? So we started with...
If you go up, there's less and less you can cancel with each other, right?
Okay, so let's have a look at this one again. You start with an operator on two sides, and you end up with an operator on two sides. If now this was the starting point for the next cross-graining, you would put it, you know, this is the next layer of cross-graining, it's a two-side operator, and you get back a two-side operator. You can iterate this, right? You start with two-side operator, you obtain a cross-grain operator acting on two sides. Now you cross-grain it again, you obtain a new cross-grain operator acting on two sides.
Okay.
Yes? So.
Okay.
Oops.
No, it's fine.
It's fine? Okay, but it might be useful. I'll have to explain this in a second. So we start with an operator, we cross-grain it, we obtain a new operator, and then we cross-grain it again, okay, we obtain a new operator, etc. Right? And this is two-side operator, this is two-side operator, and this property goes on for it. That's important. That is very important. All right, so then we put all these tensors together, all these cross-grain transformations together, and we obtain an index. That's the mirror, okay? And now what we do is, okay, when you see this tensor network, you say you start thinking, okay, there is some notion of renormalization group, or at least of cross-grain transformation associated to this ansatz, right? This is an ansatz where we're trying to represent the state of a one-dimensional system, and we do it by means of a tensor network that spans an additional direction, two dimensions. We have two dimensions, the physical one, and this one, which is associated to scale, right? As we move in this direction, where you can think of this as moving towards the cross-grain lattices. So going in this direction amounts to changing the scale in your system. So there is a notion of RG flow, or this tensor network is associated to an RG flow. Just take it like that at the moment. And then we have all these tensors. We had these entanglers, isometries. We had the constraints for these entanglers and isometries. And the top tensor, I'm just going to ask that it's normalized to one. Okay. So now you could consider this. You know, I spent half an hour trying to motivate this structure. But you could forget for a second about that and just look at this as a tensor network made of tensors with some constraints. And we want to study properties. So let's look at efficiency, for instance. Let's look at how expensive it is to compute the norm of this state. Yes?
We've seen a few examples in which we looked at an operator on a certain number of sites and coarse graining that maps a certain number of sites to one site. Can we say that in general, if an operator acts on n sites and we coarse grain p sites into one, that still the number of sites that the operator acts on is preserved?
It might be shrinking. In some cases, the number of sites might be shrinking. But the important thing is whether a local operator explodes, its support explodes or remains contained.
So what we can generalize from this example is that local operators stay local?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. Locality is preserved. Local operators stay local. Yes. Okay, so actually I forgot one thing. So is this an efficient representation? Remember properties A, B, C? Let's look at property A. Well, how many tensors do we have here? It looks like we went from, in a system of size n, now we have a two-dimensional network, so it might look like we may have n squared tensors, or it turns out that we only need to go up log n steps, because every time that you go one step up, you shrink your system by half or by one-third, so after log three steps, you're done, right? So you may think, okay, then it's n times log n, so maybe I have n times log n operator tensors here. But the truth is, if you count them, you'll see that you have order n in the first layer, order n over 3 in the second layer, and so on. So we have n tensors in the first layer, plus n over 3 in the second layer, plus n over 9, right? And you see how this goes. And so this is n of 1 plus 1 over 3 plus 1 over 9, etc. And this thing here is smaller than 2. So this is a constant. That's not dependent on n. Okay? So actually, we need order n coefficients. There are order n gates, so we need order n coefficients to completely specify the answers. Okay? So yes, property A, this is an efficient representation. And it's actually the number of coefficients that scale only linearly in the system size. So that was property A, efficient representation. Now, property B, can we efficiently compute things with this? Let's have a look at computation of the norm, or the scalar product psi with psi, where psi is represented in this way. So again, we just take the state, the ket, the bra, we multiply all the indices together, and then this looks like a messy tensor network. Okay? We may not know how to compute this, or well, there might be some cost associated to it, which could be large. But we look at the relations that we have here and say, this is U and this is U dagger. Okay? And then suddenly we can remove all this first row of these entanglers. This row goes away with this one. And automatically you realize that you end up with something where you can apply the rule. And applying the rule, these guys annihilate with these guys, and then later these guys with these guys. And eventually you realize that you just have this top tensor multiplied with the other, which has been normalized to 1. So we don't have to do anything. We don't have to actually compute anything. This state is normalized to 1, okay, by construction, by all these constraints. If we use these constraints, when we choose the tensors, automatically the state is normalized. The cost is 0. All right, so what else? What about computing expectation value of a local observer? Then what do we have here? We have, this is the expectation value of a local observer. This is the state, right? This is the ket, this is the bra, and that's the local operator. We want to compute this. And we've already discussed that, well, we still have u dagger everywhere. So these guys will go, except in the neighborhood of the operator. Then you'll have w dagger. These guys will go, and so on. So who is left? If you apply all these isometric conditions for all the tensors that where you can apply them, you can reduce without doing anything, no computational time. You can go from here to here. This is a collection of all the tensors that did not disappear. For instance, this is U and this is U dagger, but they are not annihilated because you have an abstraction in between. Okay? All right, so then this means that computing a local operator, the expectation value of a local operator, boils down to contracting this tensor network, but this is the same as this tensor network here. And now you realize that, oh, look, this is the local operator O, right? This is O, but actually the box is O prime. This box, this first box here is O prime, okay? And then, so let's have a look at O prime. Well, we have to contract this tensor network to go from this operator to this operator, and there will be some cost, okay? Some cost, which will be some power of the bond dimension of all these indices. So there will be some cost. Now, after we've done that, after we replace the box, so the content in the box by a new operator, we can go back into this picture and replace the whole box, as we do here, with the operator. So we went from a two-site operator on the original layer, original lattice, to a two-site operator on the constraint lattice. And now we're applying the constraint transformation again. And what we see is that, well, and we obtain a new two-side operator. But the important thing is that if you look at the details of this calculation, we're just repeating what we did before, in the sense that there will be a cost associated to it, but the cost is identical. Okay? So we pay some price, we pay some computational cost to go from here to here, we pay the same computational cost to coarse grain again, and finally we have some other computational cost. The idea is that we have to apply some operation. Okay, we have to go from O to O prime. There is a cost, and then O prime to O second, and so on. At every step, there is some fixed amount of computational cost. It's some power of chi. Each step is independent of n. It doesn't depend on the system size. Now, how many steps do we have to apply until we have obtained you know, this Cartesian picture, well, log n. There are log n. We have to go up in these structure log n steps. So that's the cost. It's going to be some constant times log n. So let me summarize this. So the cost of computing the expectation value of a local observable is log n, okay, times some constant, which will be some power of chi, which we don't need to care about. So the answer is yes, we can efficiently compute expectation values of local observables. We had to choose a complicated tensor network with a nice causal structure. We had to use all these constraints. But this is all. This does not involve any calculation. The only calculation you have to do in practice is within this causal cone, you have to apply log n steps. Good. So we're running out of time. What's new? But let me tell you how the two-point correlator looks like. So now we are done with computational cost, right? There is some cost associated to computing local observables. Yes?
What is the P?
P is some power. It happens to be. It depends on whether you use a 2-to-1 isometry or 3-to-1 isometry. It's on the order of 6, 7, some number. Independent of n. That's the key point. Does not depend on the system size. All right. So now what we would like to justify is that the correlations decay as a power law. And we don't have a lot of time for this, but let me get you the main idea clear, which is this will be the expectation value of operators acting, this operator here is acting on site 0, we call this site 0, and this operator is acting on site L. Okay? And we would like to see how this will scale with L. And this is a tensor network that you have to contract. Now we can use the trick that we used before, all the isometric constraints, and unfortunately I cannot put the two things. Well, I could put the two things in the same screen, but I have to zoom out. Let's not do that. But you realize that all these tensors, this is U, U dagger, they will disappear. Okay, we'll have all these cancellations, and if you think about it, and you have it also in paper in front of you. The final tensor network that you need to consider looks like this. And what is this? You have the original operators that you want to cross-grain. So what we will compute this two-point operator, this two-point correlator, by it is reduced to a process where you cross-grain your operators, you cross-grain them. You have to apply certain linear maps. So this is an operator. We apply some map to it, and we have to apply it a number of times. Okay, so how many times do we have to apply this map? Well, turns out that we have to apply this map log L times, where L is the distance between the two operators. So you have two operators sitting in your lattice. Imagine you cosign the lattice; these operators will become closer. If you cosign again, they become closer and closer. So if they start at L sides away, after log L steps, they become nearest neighbors. Okay, so you have to apply this map log L times. And once you have to apply a map log L times, then automatically, so we could look at that, but what we're saying is you have to apply something. So the expectation value of this two-point correlator can be understood, or when we compute it, we see that we have to apply something, some scaling super operator, some map, some linear map to O, log L times. And the same thing to O prime. Okay? So the point is that we have to apply this map log L times. There will be, every time we apply it, there will be some eigenvalue dominating this transformation. And so we'll have some eigenvalue lambda applied log L times. And on the other side, so we have the product of this, so there will be another lambda log L times. Altogether is lambda 2 log L times. So see, this is the dependence in L. We wanted the dependence in L. Well, it appears as the log L as a power in here. But now we just need to use that x times log y is the same as y times log x. Okay, that's a very nice mysterious equality. X log y equal to y log x. And this allows us to write this as L to what is it? So log L2 log lambda. And that's the power law. Okay? So this thing here will be minus p. Yes?
If x to the power of log
log. Yeah, this is wrong. This mysterious and magic and yeah, and wrong. So what is it? X log y equal to y to log x. Yes? Okay.
And then there's a factor of 2 on the bottom.
Yeah. You can, so this factor of 2, you can put it wherever you want. For instance, you can put it square, and then that's what you have here, L square. I had an answer for this one. All right, so okay. So what we see is that the way the tensor network has been built decides that automatically you have power law decay of correlations. Okay, the transfer metric that we need to apply is going up in scale. Remember, in the MPS, you get the transfer matrix that directly connects these two guys through L steps. Now we have the ability to connect these two guys by going up in scale and going down again. And that's what that's the essence of why we get a log L correction. Polynomial decay of correlations. And now finally, let's look at how entanglement entropy scales. Okay? And look, somebody changed back to 2 to 1 meter. So I'm changing back and forth. But that's because it's easy to explain or to draw in this case. So the idea here is that you can look at a region, say two sides, and if you try to detach these two sides from the rest of the system, when the ground state is described by this tensor network, you realize that you have to cut at least two legs. There is no way to detach these two sides from the rest without by cutting less than two legs or two bone indices. Now, if you look at a system, a region of say six sides, now you realize. If you can look at it for a while, but you realize that the shortest way you can do that, the smallest number of legs you have to cut is 4. Okay. Now, if you look at an even larger region, this region here, it contains 14 sides. Then you realize that the minimal number of legs you have to cut is 6, okay, to split that region from the rest. And as you can see, the larger and larger regions, you realize that, well, there is some number. And this number, if you look at it carefully, is growing exponentially, what is left, logarithmically. Right? So if you have a distance L here, your region is size L, you look at how many bonds you have to cut, and it's logarithmic in L. Right? And this gives you an upper bound to the entropy that the region can have. So this is only an upper bound. But numerical calculations, when you use this in practice, you realize this upper bound is saturated. Okay. So entanglement entropy in the mirror scales as log L. Good. And I'll stop here because it's very late. And tomorrow we have the last class. Remember, next week Xiaoyang will take over. Tomorrow I want to just give you an overview of where we are with tensor networks. We'll go to two dimensions briefly, see how this can be generalized to two dimensions. We'll see how to reproduce a boundary law for entanglement in two dimensions. We'll see how to reproduce the logarithmic violations of the entanglement law in two dimensions. But I think it will be more of a research talk more than a lecture because there is no way we can explain things in detail. But I want you to get the big picture.